What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Habibi House podcast. Today we have a very, very special guest, Jinan Matari.
Hi.
And you flew all the way from New York.
I did.
Just for us,
just
right?
Just for you guys.
It's funny.
Here for anything else.
It's funny because isn't Matar Airport? Does that mean
right.
You're from
yeah.
the
Matari?
Airport?
No, but it's actually Matari, which is
Matari.
Rain, like my rain.
Rain?
Yeah, Matar.
I thought it was my airport.
Yeah.
That would be funny.
Let's take your Lebanese shit and go somewhere.
Matari.
All right, Jinan. So we got a nice little intro for you.
Okay.
All right. We're thrilled to have with us the incredible Jinan Matari.
That's the whole intro.
That's all we needed. An artist, activist, mm-hmm. storyteller, mm-hmm. journalist, and most importantly, a Palestinian mother who's redefining what it means to be a force in both the creative world and social justice spaces. Jinan's work focuses on cultural preservation, challenging the status quo, and using her platform to bring attention to the voices and stories that need to be heard. Whether she's making waves with her unique projects or advocating for change, Jinan's approach is as bold as it is inspiring. Grab your shai, your ahwe, or whatever fuels you, because this conversation is one you don't want to miss, because hell hath no fury, like an Arab mom.
Welcome, Jinan.
That was pretty incredible. Did you write that?
You know, a little sprinkle of the robots here and there. and then we got to say, you know, the sponsor plug as well. We got Jinan in some chorus right now.
Yeah, this chorus. I always got to show
yeah.
the back.
Love those wings.
And this episode is proudly brought to you by Chorus, a premium streetwear brand redefining tradition through fashion. Founded by a Palestinian designer, Chorus merges heritage with modern style in its debut collections of hoodies, t-shirts, and sweatpants. Each piece is crafted from luxurious Pima cotton and inspired by the timeless beauty of the Tetris embroidery, as you can see on there. And it's designed in NYC and produced with an Arab-owned supply chain. So
shout out to Chorus and get yours today. Habibi 20
yeah,
is get, the code.
Yeah, Habibi 20% off.
Go get it. I love it. The material's so nice.
Yeah, that
the designs are really nice.
Yeah. Apparently, you can wash it like a million times and
it doesn't shrink.
Yeah, it's like intact.
Quality.
So, yeah, it's great quality. That's all we do here at Habibi House. You know what I mean?
All right. So, let's get into it.
Okay.
You're Palestinian.
Yeah.
When did you find out?
Give it away.
When did you find out when you're you're Palestinian?
That's a good question. Obviously, I always knew that we were from Palestine. I don't think I fully understand what it meant to be Palestinian until I was in my early 20s.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I always tell the story. I was raised to be just the average American kid. I'm first generation born to my family here in the States, but technically second generation raised. So my parents are immigrants, but they came here when they were very little. And so I had like a very average American upbringing. I thought that I was white until I was 23. Found out that I wasn't because of a group chat that I was in with a bunch of like other brown Muslim women.
Wait, what did they say?
And,
they were like, you know you're brown, right?
Well, they were like, we were talking about something. It was like an editorial chat. We were writing for a blog. And
you were like, as a white woman, you're like, whoa.
No, I thumbs up. Everybody was sending a thumbs up,
oh,
and I sent like
a white
the
one?
Whitest thumbs up emoji. And everybody was like, this bitch thinks she's white. And I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah, I'm white. Like, have you seen my skin? And that was like my first moment of like, oh, okay.
Did you go one shade darker?
I'm two shades darker now.
Oh, nice.
So you left the growth.
I really started exploring that like Palestinian side in my early 20s. It was 2014. It was another assault on Gaza. And I couldn't believe what I was watching. It's essentially what we've been watching, you know, for
it
the
was
last.
Like they were mowing the lawn, as they call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. I was watching terrible videos and photos of Palestinian children. And I just couldn't get over the fact that people were sharing them as if they were just numbers, and they didn't really understand that like all of these children had a story, they had a life that was stolen from them. And so I started researching my own family's history in Palestine. You know, my aunt is a doctorate in trauma psychology, specifically for Palestinian generational trauma.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Where?
Really light work.
That's beginner trauma, yeah. Right?
So her whole life has been understanding diaspora in the Palestinian community. And so, you know, I remember the first time she was going through her research for another one of her 12 degrees, mashallah, and she had told me that my grandfather was a refugee, and that was the first time that I had found out that I was a descendant of refugees. I didn't know what the Nakba was. We didn't grow up with, you know, stories from my grandfather's childhood. It was, I think, his way of dealing with trauma is that he just kind of kept it to himself. So I didn't get the stories from, you know, Teta and Jiddo and Siti and Sidi like everybody else did growing up. So it took me a little bit longer to get there. But then once I realized like where I should be, I kind of just dove right in.
Yeah. So would you say that this, that awakening in 2014 and, you know, realizing that you're not white and all that, is that the start of your journey into like the journalist side of you and like the investigative side of you?
A little bit before that, so I went to school for journalism.
Okay.
I don't know if everybody knows that. Yeah, I have a degree in it.
Yeah.
So there's always been a part of me that was, you know, a good writer. I was interested in writing. I could connect with people through writing. I've always kind of had some sort of a blog. But in 2014 is when it really shifted into like culture and identity type of work.
Yeah, because I mean, like, you're very creative when it comes to your activism, I think, and you marry like the activism, the journalism, and, you know, delivering it in a digestible way for the audience, whether you are Middle Eastern or not. I think you do a good job of giving it,
blending,
blending it. So and then you have like, you're just like one page, like, word posts that is just very straight to the point. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was always very bad at like
sugarcoating things.
Just like fluff. You know, like every time I would write, like, you know, with the journalism degree, you have to write so many papers and they have to be a certain length. You have to have a certain amount of words. Yeah. And I was like, I don't understand why I have to give you this paper with 10,000 words when I can say exactly what I have to say in 500.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I could beat through all of the, you know, the fluff. I don't have to give you all of these like filler words.
Yeah. I mean, they literally call them fluff pieces.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you just posted, I think you said put 14,000 kids, right?
Yes.
And that's.
Yeah. Staggering numbers. And that's at least, all those numbers are always like the bare minimum, right?
Yeah. It's like, what they're able to record.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for some reason, I mean, I guess there was like a little bit of a benefit to like growing up thinking that I was like the average American, because I think I understand how the average American mind works now because of it.
Yeah.
All the things that distract it, all of the things that like interest it, how I can catch its attention and kind of keep it there.
Yeah.
So I have used it, you know, to my benefit.
Talking about distraction, we have some emergency topics.
Okay.
I mean, what the heck happened last night? We have Israeli embassy, D.C. Like, can we like unpack that? Real quick or real long, I don't know. Which it's like some people are saying it's a false flag. Some people are saying, you know, it's just, you know, a rogue actor. So have you...
Rest in peace, first of all.
Who?
Cool.
People died, right?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh.
Allegedly. I didn't see any bodies.
I will say, there are enough false flags for this to be everybody's first thought.
Sure.
I read something that I really connected with. Actually, I read it while I was on the plane. And it was saying that we should be very cautious to label things as false flags when something like this happens. People did it also with, you know, Luigi. And instead, we have to be just very mindful that when people are watching this extreme violence, because we know that this happened in the context of Gaza, that we as a society have to expect that when the law is not being upheld and when all of these systems that we've been taught and, you know, made out to believe are put in place to protect us and to stop these atrocities from happening, when they're not doing those things, we have to expect some sort of societal dissent and retaliation.
We've seen it almost in the past couple months, very, I mean, when did Luigi have, it feels like it just
forever ago. Yeah. I have no concept of time anymore.
But with Luigi, with Rodney Hinton, mm-hmm. and then now with Elias mm-hmm. and Rodriguez, mm-hmm. All targeting different aspects of systemic oppression, right? Mm-hmm. You have like the medical industry, mm-hmm. you have police brutality, mm-hmm. and you have now Gaza, mm-hmm. and they're all tied together.
Yeah.
And I mean, is this just the natural progression when like the law is just not being upheld? This is it. Like, you know, you take dramatic measures in dramatic times, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the next step is. This isn't to like, you know, advocate for that type of.
Yeah.
But I'm also not in a position to tell anybody what's right or wrong when it comes to trying to stop a genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the most drastic way of bringing, I mean, you, obviously with Aaron Bushnell, mm-hmm. you know, self-immolating. Yeah, so like, I don't know if it's just because we have a lot more, you know, access mm-hmm. and we feel like it's happening more, but I do feel like people are just not standing for it anymore.
Yeah, you know? I think everybody has a breaking point.
Yeah.
It's different for everyone, and it is, you know, it comes to life in different ways. All of the very drastic things that people are doing to get their point across, I always think of like how much pain someone must be in, and it takes a lot to do something that drastic. So,
it's, I mean, and then as a, you know, you said you are good at writing, and then I'm sure you look at the media spin of everything, right? Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, there was an incident in Miami where a Jewish person shot two Israeli people
thinking they were
Palestinian.
Yeah.
And then like that kind of fizzled out. I don't think it wasn't really mainstream too much. And then this happens and now it's like, it's going to be this, everyone's afraid that this is going to be the, where the state really uses this idea to crack down on people.
Yeah.
So
I think they're trying to criminalize saying Free Palestine. Is that what they,
yeah. I mean, you had, you know, the Polish guy that's running, Israel. He's
Polish.
The guy from Philly.
That's right.
Ben. A good old Ben.
Milinowski, right?
He's Milikowski. He's saying literally that he's equating Free Palestine to like the new like Nazi slogan essentially, and it's hilarious to see like they're just grasping at straws now. There's no, I mean, at least growing up, you know, you saw like they were at least creative with it. Now they're just like. Saying.
Yeah, they're getting lazy.
Yeah.
Well, before they had a problem with From the River to the Sea.
Right.
Because they said it was genocidal.
Yeah.
But
now. Because it was for them. Did you know that?
Tell me about it.
Yeah. So if you understand the history of propaganda, you learn that all of it is recycled. So when we say From the River to the Sea, we mean freedom, liberation for everybody within the borders of Palestine, historic Palestine.
Even Jewish people.
Everybody.
I know. I have to sometimes say the words so that people can understand.
Yes, everybody. Mm-hmm. And so, but they're, so if you.
But they took it as saying kick everyone out and kill people and all that, right?
Yes, because that's what it means for them. So colonizers, we can go into like American history.
This phrase was used before, is what you're saying.
Yeah,
I've heard that before.
So like there's a song that we teach kids in American schools, and there's a phrase in it that's it's this land is your land, this land mm-hmm. is my land. And there's a lyric that is from sea to shining sea. Mm. And for European settlers, it was complete domination of indigenous lands and people from Pacific to the Atlantic.
So that was used for the conquest of America from sea
and
to
like
sea.
And like propaganda, like I said, is consistently recycled throughout history.
Yeah.
And so when they hear indigenous people calling for liberation from the river to the sea, it triggers this like weird colonial trauma for them that they've enacted on other people.
Right.
So it's an interesting, like part of my degree was like understanding the social psychology of, you know, media and propaganda and public relations.
So. But so then they had a problem with that. And now they just have a problem with saying free.
With everything.
With being free. with free.
With freedom. Yeah.
Free Palestine.
Yes. Free Palestine.
All day, every day. Let's get into being a Palestinian mom.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're a mother, you're a powerful advocate for Palestinian rights. How do you navigate the emotional and psychological toll of being both a mom and a Palestinian woman in a world that often feels stacked against your people? And do you find yourself having to protect your child from the harsh realities of what's going on? Or are you teaching them to understand it all from a young age?
Those are very heavy questions.
Feel as comfortable as you.
The first one, I think, when it comes to how I get through it, I married a very good man.
Yeah, that's a good way to start. Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't do anything that I'm doing without the support system that I have at home. People always think that marriage is like 50-50, but it's got to be 100% all the time from each person. And sometimes it's more than 100% from one of the partners. So there have absolutely been times, especially over the last 19 months, my youngest was only 1 year old when all this had started. So I had a literal baby when all of this had started.
Yeah.
Very early in my postpartum. And so I was not, you know, mentally or emotionally okay, sure. But I was just kind of in the zone. I knew that, you know, our community needed more voices. I knew that I needed to be strong. I knew that I was lucky to be in diaspora and to have my children like safely with me at home. And so it wasn't an option for me to be able to like turn it off and focus on like my mental health, which is what a lot of people were trying to advocate for Palestinians to do, especially in the beginning. And so there were a lot of times where I was not all there. And my husband really filled in and made sure that the kids were okay, made sure that if I couldn't have dinner ready, that there was something for everybody to eat. He took care, still takes care of the whole house.
Yeah.
And he really just lets me focus on this type of work.
Incredible.
So, yeah, I don't give him enough flowers.
Well, now it's permanent. It's solidified here. And then one step outside of like the nuclear family, like the, you know, like the immediate family, you have the community, right?
Yes.
You need to be able to lean on community. Even your sibling, you know, you have Zach Materi, you know, the homie. I wish he was here, but he's like traveling to Norway and stuff. You know, he's a rock star. But, you know, you got to have that too. You got to be able to, when you, I keep saying, well, it's been said to me and I've been really trying to apply is like, when you need to recharge, you got to lean on community. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the only silver linings of the past 19 months is that the community really came together. Like, I've never seen anything like this. So
I'll agree. Yeah. I've met some of my best friends in the last 19 months doing this work with some people. So it sucks that this is how we all had to find each other.
Yeah.
But like you said, a very unfortunate silver lining.
It is bittersweet. Are there a lot of events in your neck of the woods, in like the East Coast? Like,
I'm not too far from Patterson. So if you don't know what Patterson is, it's basically Little Palestine in New Jersey.
Oh, nice, nice.
So a very large.
Patchers.
Yeah.
Patchers. There's something there, Palestine.
I grew up around the community, not fully like immersed in it. There was definitely still a little bit of a disconnect there. But I'm finding my way back and, you know, I'm finding community and where we are now. And I'm grateful to have, you know, like you said, my extended family, my parents, my brothers. Actually, I have another brother that nobody knows about, but I think he likes to keep it that
way. Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah. I just, you know, my in-laws are incredible. I'm just very grateful to have the support system that I do. And everybody has really filled in where they saw gaps or where they saw that I was slipping and just really needed help. And I think it's really important to like acknowledge the people that allow us to do the type of work that we do.
Yeah. I mean, I think we mentioned this before, but the concept of samud, right. Mm-hmm. Procreating is resistance. Mm-hmm. What do you say to, let's say like women out there or just people wanting to start a family, but feeling very reserved and hesitant in these times, you know, they're like, oh, what am I bringing my baby into? How do you feel about that? And what do you say to people that are hesitating?
So for me personally, I don't know that I've ever hesitated to like want that family. I always kind of acknowledge that the world was going in some dark places. But I heard something. I was watching a documentary with a bunch of climate activists, and there was an indigenous woman who talked about how procreation, that's a weird word. I don't like that word.
It's very scientific.
It is.
Yeah.
It's just building your family, like having children as indigenous people is like a way to kind of ensure that the world will always have people to protect it. And everybody thinks that it's the end of the world, right? Like every generation that has ever existed on this planet is convinced that they're going to be the last one to see it.
Sure.
And I think what isn't always recognized is that indigenous people all over this planet have experienced their end of the world many times over. And the only way that they have survived it is to continue bringing indigenous children into this world. And like I said, it's a way to ensure that there is a next generation of people who will continue to fight for the planet, who will work hard to protect the planet and all of its living beings on it. And so whenever somebody is hesitant to have kids specifically for that reason, because there's a ton of reasons why somebody should not bring kids into this world. But specifically when it comes to, you know, being concerned with the state of the world, that's something that I always mention to them, is that, you know, we have seen the end of the world many times over. People in Gaza are watching the end of the world every single day, and they are still having children.
Yes.
And that's proof of survival.
Yeah.
I have a question for you.
You've never interviewed a mom.
I know, right?
Well, I think we have.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know Farah Nabulsi. She's been working. We just had her. Well, we did it like an express episode somewhere.
She's got like grown kids,
she's
though.
She's incredible.
Yeah, she's great.
Speaking of moms, Mrs. Rachel got like put on the New York Times, called like a Hamas supporter and all this. What do you have to say to her?
Miss Rachel and I are Instagram buddies. I don't know if
you knew this. Now we know.
Yeah. So we've had some lovely conversations in DM.
What do you say to each other?
Just checking in on each other as moms. Me, obviously, I'm nobody, so I check in on her, especially when the news cycle is very crazy when it comes to, you know, her being the headlines of things like that.
Yeah.
But she is very focused on doing the right thing. And I don't know that there's anything that anybody can say about her or to her that will deter her from continuing to advocate for Palestine. And it's actually something that I, not to toot my own horn, but a year ago, she had posted her first thing about Palestine. And she had,
kids.
Yeah, she got, it was literally just like, stop bombing kids.
Yeah.
I don't even know that there was anything about like Palestinian kids in it.
And she was like, what?
Yeah.
How dare you say that?
And she even, it was a post and she included Gaza. She didn't say Palestine. She said Gaza. She said Ukraine. She said Sudan. She said the Congo. So it was a ton of kids and they just came for her throat. And I remember her posting a video of her crying. At night, saying that the bullying had gotten so bad. Right. But she was like, but I can do this. I know that this is right. And I know that I have to push through. And I had made a video of that video just being like, this is a person, specifically a mother, but this is a person who has decided that she will push past her own discomfort to advocate for what's right. And like, it's only going to get stronger. And that's exactly what's happened. Her language has gotten more direct. She has specifically said Palestine, Palestinian kids. You know, there are a lot of people who will only say the word Gaza, who will call Palestinians in Gaza Gazans because they don't want to say the word Palestinians. So her language is evolving with each post, and it's getting stronger and more direct. And being able to, like, survive that, like, you know, smear campaign is a very big thing for somebody in her position.
And then seeing her collaborate with Mahdi Hassan was cool.
Yeah.
Seeing that crossover.
Yeah.
That was really cool to see. And
we'd like to officially invite Miss Rachel on the podcast.
Well, Miss Rachel, and I think I just saw Alana Hadid post about her and Mahdi are collaborating in June.
Yeah.
So they're going to be here in LA next month. So that's
so really Mahdi,
cool.
I guess.
Yeah,
come
yeah,
on.
Yeah. Pull up, Brown.
Alana,
boys.
You're cool too. You know, you're like, but we go way back.
One of the, I hate to be this guy, but with Miss Rachel, you're talking about the.
You love
the
to
language.
Be this guy.
I am.
You love to be this guy.
I do love to be this guy.
I don't even know what he's going to say.
Yeah,
but
well,
he's loving this moment.
Well, yeah, there have been some eyebrow raising posts where you see in the X comments or any or Instagram comments, it's like they got to her. You know what I mean? They being the opposing side, you'd say, where she posts something and she literally just immediately turns off the comments. And it's about, like, even today, about,
the two people
at the embassy.
We should make it very clear that those are two people that worked in the Israeli embassy, one of whom definitely served in the IDF.
And his post
was very, very pro-genocide.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he's a terrorist.
Yeah, he is.
And, they shouldn't be walking around, peacefully. That's my take. Anyway,
I do not agree with that opinion.
I know you don't.
For the record,
I don't think
anyone should die. And I think this kind of goes back to what was Mr. Rachel was saying, which is like she's advocating for, innocent people not being killed,
but they're not innocent.
I'm just saying in general. I mean, I've seen a couple of her posts before where I guess some would say she's both sizing it. But how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, very clearly, I will say I will never advocate for people dying.
Of course.
But it is a very important distinction to understand that the two people who were the target of last night's events were not random people off the street. Mm-hmm. They were coming out of an event about the genocide happening. Right. And they are a part of the governing power that is enacting this genocide. So that's what I'll say about that.
Yeah.
When it comes to Miss Rachel's stuff, I think that she is very much the epitome of somebody who might not know all the things there is to know about colonialism, but just genuinely feels for people, like just genuinely wants to see everybody happy and healthy. And there is, when there is a moment in your journey when you do understand what being decolonial actually means. And I think that we need to be decolonial to understand what Palestinians are struggling for, how to achieve freedom, what it should look like.
Seems like people are learning.
Yeah, they're learning.
You know?
Yeah, and yeah.
Maybe they don't know how to necessarily speak or what, terms to use or how to approach things.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of people I feel like are learning, are being more vocal, even if they've held their tongue for a while. You see that as good, right?
I do.
You're the type of person to educate them.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think we're in the, or we're at least approaching the, everybody will have always been against this phase.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I go back and forth with great for you that you're,
I posted that
out,
one, All Eyes on Rafah once.
Yeah.
And I did my part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Or not even that,
Yeah.
I just,
one day we'll.
There's a lot of things that have happened over the last 19 months that I feel like a genocide should not have been the catalyst for people to, find themselves or figure out what they're supposed to do in this world or, suddenly find God. I don't think it should take you watching 300,000 people to die to,
Yeah.
Finally decide that, actually, yes, this is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a whole episode on that, but
I think people are just, a lot of people, it didn't affect them, and they started to see stuff, and then they didn't know if their silence was complicity.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has I am reminded every single day that people are not exposed to the same things that I'm exposed to. There are a ton of people who, when I put out a new educational video, will be like, what's the point? Everybody already knows what they need to know about Palestine. It's not true.
Yeah.
And I will actually credit my hairstylist for that.
Tell me.
I went to her, the first time that I went to her salon, we were just having a conversation and she was asking me what I did, and I was kind of like, you know, beating around the bush because you just never know.
Right.
I've been burned before. And so when it got to, you know, who I am and what I do and where my family comes from, she was like, you were afraid to tell me that you were Palestinian? And I was like, yeah, girl, do you know what people, how people yeah. feel about Palestinians these days? And so we just got into, you know, a lovely conversation. And I was like, I am at a point where I understand that everybody has a different starting point for education. And so I was like, what do you know about Palestine before I start talking? So I know where to start. Sure. And she was like, look around my salon. There's like these neon signs with like Taylor Swift quotes and Taylor Swift playing in the background. And she's like, what you see in here is what I see on my Instagram feed. It's what I talk about with my friends and my colleagues. So I know nothing.
Okay.
And this was,
Taylor Swift.
Yeah. And this was like 15 months into the genocide. And so I was like, okay, I can respect that. So she was like, start from the beginning. So I literally started from the beginning. We talked about colonialism. We talked about the British Mandate in Palestine. We talked about how Israel was created, why it was created. We talked about our, how our taxes are going, you know, to fund everything that we're watching. We're going, we were going into what AIPAC was. And so
a whole crash course.
Yes. And it was just a good reminder for me that like this country and this American society, Western society, whatever you want to call it, is literally designed to make sure that you don't know anything about what actually matters in this world. And again, going back to the, this is the average American mind. I once had it. I know what distracts people. I know what they would prefer to be watching or listening to than, you know, watching our suffering. And it's just a like, it's a good reminder for me, which is why I always tell people, you have to do your work online. You have to also do it in your real life.
Sure.
You have to be able to figure out how to translate whatever work you're doing on the internet into your real waking life. If you can convince one person in your real world life to be 100% pro-Palestine, that is an unbelievable success. Just one person. And there are people that I've had in my life for 30 plus years that I haven't gotten to be 100% pro-Palestinian. That means everything from...
What does that mean?
Yeah, that means everything that requires Palestinians to achieve liberation.
Right.
That is us achieving all of our land back. That is acknowledging the importance of Palestinian resistance, that is respecting, you know, Palestinian culture and tradition and understanding the importance of things like Tathriz, right? Like, if you can get somebody to really get on that page with you, you made such a difference in the world.
I saw, I'm seeing a trend. There's people wearing and saying things like, I support military intervention to stop the Gaza genocide. Like, I think we've reached that point where people are just saying it out loud. I'm seeing that everywhere. It's
There's a lot of veterans that are on that.
And you know, touching on what you just said a little bit earlier, you said something about you know, somebody saying like, why does it matter, like, you know, are you tired? How do you keep fighting? Like, what keeps you motivated to pursue justice?
One, because it's the right thing to do. My faith and just the way that I was raised, I was always told to do the right thing, and this is the right thing. And two, I have children.
Yeah,
I gotta like raise people in this world that everybody likes to talk about how shitty it is, and I need to figure out how to make it better. I'm already behind in how I thought the world would be by the time I brought children into it, and so I feel like I'm definitely trying to play catch up. But I don't want them to grow up in a world where, you know, the reason why I was raised to think that I was a white American was for safety purposes. I don't want them to have to live in a world where they can't tell people who they are or where our family comes from because they don't know how they're going to react, or they don't know if they'll be safe, or they have to, you know, fight for the fact that their identity is real in a classroom setting, which a lot of kids have to do. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. And I think, for me, having children just is what keeps me focused because they're growing up very quickly.
Yeah.
So I'm going to fix a lot of stuff really fast.
Well, do you have any advice for people that don't have children?
Go have some children.
Do it for other people's kids, please.
Do it for the future generations, you know?
No, I really believe, for me, I call it diaspora debt. I think.
Diaspora what?
Diaspora debt.
Debt.
Yes, like, this is my debt to my people. Mm. I get to live this comfortable, privileged life mm-hmm. because my grandfather went through this.
Yeah, I like that more than survivor's guilt. You know?
Yeah, no. I don't know that we have. Like, if you talk to, again, if you talk to, you know, psychologists, that they'll tell you that it's not survivor's guilt that we're all feeling. We owe it to our community that is holding it down back home to do whatever we can with the privilege that we have been afforded because of where we are in this generational timeline, right? And we also just owe it to the world to make it better. Like, people, a lot of people exist on this planet thinking that it owes them, that like they can just take and not give anything back and not put any effort into making sure that they are not causing any harm to anyone or to the planet itself. And so I think that we have to reprogram our minds to understand that we don't get to just move on this planet and whatever happens, happens. Like, we have to move with intention. We have to do things that make it better. We have to leave this place better than how we inherited it. And the way that we inherited it is pretty trash. So we have a lot of cleaning up to do. You have to be very intentional with the way that you live your life.
Let's talk about your book. You have a children's book out.
I do. Yeah. I have a children's book out.
Let's talk about it.
It's called Everything Grows in Jitta's Garden.
Love that.
Jitta means grandfather. Yeah. Yes. In Arabic.
And garden.
No, I'm sorry. and it is the story of, my grandfather, Muhammad. God bless him, he's 89 years old and he's still gardening every single day. But it's how I learned about why his garden was so important to him while I was growing up. Mm. Again, average American mind. I was like, why is this old man? He's been old my whole life. So I was like, why is this old man breaking his back with this garden every single day when you can go to the grocery store and just buy fruit, just buy cucumbers? Like, you don't have to go through all this. And I never asked him. This all came from an interview that I did with my grandparents 3 years ago. And they were telling me, you know, just their life story. I think it's really important that we record our elders and that we have, you know, some sort of like visual of them telling their own stories for future generations, because it's different when you get it from the source versus when it's passed down, you know, orally. And so I was just, you know, recording our family history. I wanted to know what their life was like pre-Nakba. I wanted to learn what it was like post-Nakba.
Right.
All the things that, like I said, he didn't talk about while I was growing up. And in the middle of, you know, recording all of this history, my grandmother tells me this story about, I learned that my great-grandfather taught my Jiddu how to garden. He was a landscaper in Palestine pre-Nakba. And, my grandmother was telling me a story about how when they had finally made it to Jordan, my grandfather was, you know, finally successful and they built their own house. And it was during the Civil War. It was called Black September. They couldn't leave their house. They had two kids. One of them was my mother at the time. They couldn't leave their house without being afraid to like get shot in the crossfires of the Civil War. And so I was like, you know, how did you get food? That was the first thing that came to mind with two little kids. And she was like, well, Jiddu had a garden in, you know, the courtyard of our home. And we lived off of his garden for weeks.
Wow.
And so, like, that was the moment where I was like, okay, now I understand Jiddu's connection to his garden. And also, over the years, I've learned the importance of, you know, indigenous connection to land.
Yeah.
So the book is meant to be like, it's an honor, you know, it's to honor that story and his life as a Palestinian Nakba survivor, but also it's an introduction for children to understand indigenous connection to land and a starting point to start learning about the Nakba.
Right. Well, talking about recording and interviews, you don't do podcasts that much, do you? Because I feel like this might be your first Arab podcast that you've been on, or Arab American at least.
No, I've done a couple. Why am I bad at it?
No. I just have
I've never done in person. This is my first in person podcast.
You're doing amazing.
Because I keep like my teeth are hitting.
Honestly, we need it. Can you stay on? You're all part of our podcast now.
Wait. So first podcast ever in person?
Ever in person. Wow. I've always done virtual. Amazing. Yeah.
Let's go. Yeah.
All right, well.
Well, now you can't leave.
Yeah,
well,
yeah. Now I'm never doing it any other way.
So now we have a joke happening, right? We have a Palestinian and an anti-Zionist Jewish walk into a podcast studio. This is Matt Lieb, everybody. He's in the house.
Hey, what's up?
What's up, Matt?
Hey.
He's really tall.
Yeah.
Like if you thought you were tall,
I saw some.
Think again.
I saw like an ex, I guess it was Twitter when you tweeted it.
Mm-hmm.
You said like something about people say 6'5 and 3/8 or something.
Yeah. Well,
is that the specific?
I am 6'6.
Yeah.
But I'm 6'5 and a half and a quarter. So I'm 6'5 3/4. But with shoes on, I'm 6'6. I'm 6'6. That's the most important part.
That's the I'm 6'6, guys.
A lot of people like to dispute that.
get the measuring tape out right now.
Yeah, you can get the measuring tape out right now, but make sure my shoes are on. Shoes count.
Yeah.
Hair doesn't. Okay.
So the boots, so the 3-inch lift in the boots count, but not the hair.
That's right.
Okay, cool.
Goddamn right.
Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
What did you do during your adolescence to make sure that you're 7 feet?
What I did was every night I would stretch my legs out. Literally, I would do this.
Okay.
And I would just be like, just be taller than my brother. Just be taller than my brother. Because I thought that would mean that I could beat him up.
Mm.
Turned out it was just, he just would beat up a really tall me.
I'm just receiving punches from down.
It was crazy.
Is growing up in a Jewish household the same as an Arab household, you'd say?
I mean, I don't know. Did your older brother beat the shit out of you?
I am the older brother beating the shit out of my younger brother.
All right. So. Well, now I'm afraid. Now I'm afraid.
What was your upbringing like?
My upbringing in general, I mean, it was, I grew up in West LA. I have an older brother and I have a twin sister.
Is she also 6'6"?
No.
She's 8 feet tall.
Yeah, it'd be crazy. That would be so sad. How tall are you?
I'm 5'8". Actually, that's really tall
that's
for
tall.
A girl.
That's perfectly fine. That's a great height.
Yeah.
It's a great height.
So you identify as an anti-Zionist Jew?
Yes, I am an anti-Zionist Jew.
As a Palestinian.
And you identify as a Zionist Palestinian?
No. You should go on the record being like, no, I don't.
Absolutely not. Fucker on the internet.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
People like to clip things.
They love it.
Put it out of context.
Well, I have a question for you. How important is it to have anti-Zionist Jews as part of the movement?
It's so important because I am not doing any more work for the Jewish
100%.
The baton's off to you.
100% agree.
So thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to.
Yeah. Got to be the most annoying thing in the world, I think. This is, without being a Palestinian, I can only imagine how fucking annoying it is to have to hold the hands of people who are supporting a genocidal apartheid state. Because you don't want to hurt their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Or burst their bubble.
Yeah, it's insane to me. It's just one of those things that makes me mad whenever I see people tone policing people. Because I'm just like, it's for the sake of your weak ass fucking feelings that you're tone policing literally everyone around you. And at no point can you look outside of yourself. It's a level of narcissism that I thought... was not possible.
Right.
It's like we're in the future now, and instead of like flying cars, we just have like technologically advanced ways of giving a shit about only yourself, which is wild to me.
Yeah.
So do you think that you have to police tone yourself, or you decided not to?
I don't tone police people.
Okay.
Especially now, it's become one of the things where after October 7th, everyone, well, not everyone, but a much larger group of people in the United States started becoming aware of what Israel is.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they are sort of in the process of discovering how to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And some people make it their job to be like, don't say that.
That's not the right way to do it.
That's not the right way to do it. And I think that those people are incredibly counterproductive. And I understand the impulse and it comes from a place of their own personal comfort.
Sure.
And at some point you have to be like, does your own personal comfort like supersede genocide? How insane do you have to be to just be like, it gives me the ick when you say Zionist. And it's like, well, we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
So either get on board.
Can we not use the word genocide?
Yeah, can we not? Is there like a softer, sweeter term for killing women and children? Yeah.
What do you guys see a free Palestine looking like?
So a free Palestine is, for me, and again, this is coming from somebody in diaspora, so whatever Palestinians in Palestine want is what a free Palestine should look like.
So that's what supersedes.
That's what supersedes everything.
Because usually I, as an Arab who is not Palestinian, defer to the Palestinians in the diaspora, or the ones over there. So goes what they want, and then you, and as a person in the diaspora,
Yeah, the way I imagine it,
you want them to be free.
Yeah, I want my people to be free in our homeland, from the river to the sea. That includes dignity and freedom and justice for all people who are living in historic Palestine, regardless of faith, of cultural identity. And whatever our family wants in Palestine for Palestine is what diaspora helps them work towards. Mm. And that's my answer.
And Matt?
Same.
You're like, whatever she wants.
No, no, I mean, like, literally. That's the correct way of looking at it, especially since, like, negotiating it seems to be the big, like, thing that it's almost like it's like the Zionist gotcha. Well, what should happen?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very simple answer, which is whatever the liberated people of Palestine want to happen.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Anything can happen, but we're putting the cart before the horse when we start negotiating. Like, so the settlers in the West, and it's just like, shut up. No, yeah. I'm not.
They can go.
Yeah. I mean, clearly. Yeah. I mean, the liberated people of Palestine want.
Yeah. Even as a Palestinian in diaspora, I cannot speak on behalf of people in Palestine. Yeah. We all have to, like you said, we all have to understand our place. It's not about us. It is about the people who deserve freedom.
Yeah.
Well, and coexist bumper stickers for everybody.
Right.
I'm done. Delete this all.
Get out. No. Well, Janan, thank you so much.
Well, first thing is, thank you for coming. And sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But I think, conversations like this, dialogues like this across the table with Palestinians, with Jewish people, with people in diaspora, with people that just, don't know how it's going to, what's going to happen, but we want it to be better, So thank you for, being a voice for your people.
Oh, it's my honor.
Thank you for literally getting off the flight and coming straight to the studio.
My pleasure. I won't be anybody else ever again.
Yeah, you heard it here first. Habibi House exclusive. But Janan, I appreciate you so much. And nice. I hope that your first in-person podcast was
yeah, this was cool. Yeah. I don't want to do it over computer anymore.
So much better.
Go get her book too, for your kids.
Get
your nieces.
Get your Chorus merch. Remember Habibi 20 for 20% off. And that's a wrap.
Awesome. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, let's cut it.
How was that?
Yeah.
Good?
It seemed good.
How did you feel?
It was good. I felt good.
Okay, then
don't get me in trouble with Miss Rachel though.